So it's good seeing you.
Yeah, nice to see you.
So how's Macworld so far?
Oh, it's been blissful for me seeing my book out there and getting lots of positive feedback about it. And also, I was blown away by Steve's keynote. I think Apple these days is really hitting on all cylinders, doing incredible stuff. The company's more healthy than I've ever seen it.
Oh, yeah. So what products in particular are just blowing your mind?
Well, the single thing that caught my attention at the keynote was when he was showing the iChat video conferencing and the way they had the imagination and moxie to put the reflection of it on the bottom, right. You know, as if it was a tabletop or something. I just thought that was fantastic.
That's cool. Yeah, it's great to see the hardware be able to do that nowadays.
Yeah.
So what do you think about the new Mac Mini and that sort of stuff?
The Mac Mini, I think, is fantastic. I've been waiting for a long time for Apple to really try to expand the user base, and the Mac Mini looks like it very well can do that.
Kind of compete with the Walmart sort of $5.99 special type things?
Yeah, well, I think every dollar you knock off the price brings in more people to the platform. So I don't think there's any magical price point, but this is Apple really trying to reach out. And in a certain way, I think it's a courageous move, too, because it has the potential to cannibalize the sales of their more profitable machines. So I think it takes some guts, and I'm glad to see Apple confident enough to do something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's confidence in the platform.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and this is the kind of thing you expected to see when, I remember when I was reading the book, that the price point was a lot lower than what it actually came out to be.
Yeah, in fact, the $500 price point that the iMac Mini finally achieved was Jeff Raskin's original goal, back before anything was designed or anything. $500 wasn't, and I tell a story in my book called Price Fight, how it gradually rose to $1,500, and we held it there for the entire development of the Mac, right. And then felt utterly betrayed when the initial price was $1,000 more than that. Because we really were trying to make this for our friends. And if it was under 2000, you know, the price of an Apple II was kind of the sweet spot in our minds, which was always around $1,500, at least, you know, for the newer ones when they came out. The iPod Shuffle, I feel more mixed about. You know, I just don't see how it could not have a display because it makes it impossible to find a song. Right. And even if you're playing randomly, you know, you use the random play to discover new music, but then how do you know how to get back to it? You hear a song you haven't heard and you like, but you have no idea how to find it again.
I mean, it's definitely hitting that low price point. Like, there was a pair of sunglasses that I think Oakley came out with that actually had an MP3 player embedded in the glasses itself. So I think they're trying to...
Sure. A low price point is terrific, but the product has to work for people. Right. And I would find, without the display, I don't think it would work for me.
Right. Comparing Apple Now to the Apple that you were at a long time ago, Apple Now is actually kind of, in a sense, driven in part by the iPod, in large part.
Yes.
Yeah, which is
Is a really new thing. It's great for Apple to have a tiger by the tail and a tremendous hit on their hands. Yeah. I mean, it just blew me away. 4.5 million units in just one quarter.
All right, let's get on to your book. So let's start from the beginning. So folklore.org, tell me a little about how you started with that.
Well, you know, I've been telling these stories for years, and various people have been telling me to write them down. I'm also a really avid reader of especially fiction. And my whole life I wanted to be a novelist. So, I wanted to become a writer. But I was a little bit shy for two reasons. One is sort of just betraying the confidence of my colleagues. You know, people just don't expect you to go write about intimate interactions. And then the second thing was so many books about Apple had already come out that were extremely self-serving in the sense that, the author had an agenda of saying, explaining themselves. And I thought were a little bit distorting. And so I was shy about doing that until I hit on the idea of airing the stories out on the web first and inviting all the people I worked with to contribute. Right. So my original concept was it wasn't my thing. My thing would be the software that I developed to allow this collective storytelling and then let the team tell the story. Didn't work out quite as well as I hoped. I got contributions from, about 10 original Mac team members, but not very many of them. So it ended up being mostly my stories. But the book, I actually fought for having more people included in the book, but my editor actually thought a consistency of tone was important. And but we did get four other original MAC team members to have stories in the book. Bruce Horn, Steve Capps, Susan Kerr, and Don Denman. Don wrote one of my very favorite stories in the whole book, which was about Burl's defender playing strategies called Make a Mess, Clean It Up. We used to play defender all the time. We started, you know, there was a pizza joint across from our office in Texaco Towers. Burl and I, eventually a few other people would go over there around 4 p.m., and Burl got better. You know, after doing it for a month or two, Burl would just play for one quarter. We'd all just watch him because he could just go for practically forever. But Don describes, Burl was an extremely creative individual, as you can tell if you read any of the stories in the book. And he came up with a really unique way to get good at Defender, which is that, you know, if you know the Defender video game, the object is to, you have these little men on the ground that these flying green creatures pick up, and if they take them all the way to the top, they get destroyed and they turn into mutants, which are harder to kill. And so Burl realized that to get really, really good at the game, what you need to do is learn how to deal with the mutants. So what he would do is when he started the game, he'd fly across the bottom of the screen and kill all his men, the opposite of what you're supposed to do. And that what that would do is create a swarm of these mutants that were hard to fight. But because he practiced against the hardest situation in the game, he got to be able to master it. So I thought that was a great metaphor for his unusual creative strategies.
Right. What did you intend to kind of say about Apple in the book? I mean, who's your ideal reader, and what are you trying to tell them?
Well, I think I tried to tell a multidimensional story. There's a lot of different threads and aspects, and I wanted to hit as many of them as I could. In fact, one of my disappointments is I am limited by my own experience, and I wanted more people involved with the Macintosh factory, with the Macintosh marketing, even with the Macintosh finance department to chime in. And I think my book is a little bit limited in that I didn't get enough of that, but I really wanted to cover all the bases. But the soul of the book, I think, is two things. One is the personalities of the individuals. One of the lessons is extraordinary products are created by extraordinary people. So I wanted to really let the personalities of some of the key creators of the Mac shine through. And then the other thing is I wanted to sort of make clear to everyone this, what I call the spirit of the Macintosh, which is a mixture of artistic pride, you know, moxie, ambition, a little bit of arrogance, but just to let that shine through. What the, you know, try to boil it down to its essence. But not, in most places in the book, not really explicitly state that, but just let that kind of hang in the air around everyone's actions. And then in the very last essay in the book, I tried to make it explicit.
What do you think was really unique about the development? Obviously, the people were really unique, but putting it in terms of today and what we can learn and how we can learn from the success of the development, what do you see?
Well, I don't know about unique because in many ways what the Macintosh did was recapitulate the Apple II. We had this shining example in front of us, the work of Steve Wozniak, who was an absolute genius. In a way, the story of the development of the Apple II was a love story, the love story of Woz and computers. Woz being an incredibly talented guy, you know, a genius, really. He has stories about how when he was in junior high school, just designing computer after computer on paper that he never had the money to build. He was bored in math class because he already knew all the math that they were trying to teach him. So instead, he'd just sit there designing computers on paper. He fell in love with a mini computer architecture called the Data General Nova. And he just implemented the Nova himself. And he was shocked when he was 16 years old. He sent Data General, or he got the schematics for the real Nova and saw that his design was actually much better, even though he was a 16-year-old kid. Anyway, I have lots of Woz stories. But we had this... we were all such fans of the Apple II, and Steve Jobs even explicitly stated it, that at one point they said, well, you know, we're reincarnating the Apple II for the 1980s in one thing. So the Mac wasn't so much unique as Apple, though was unique in the sense that it was full of love and passion more than commercial values. So if I had to put my finger on the one unique thing, it's people who love what they're doing, making something that they wanted for themselves more than anything else in the world. And the financial considerations, while important, are secondary to the artistic and romance of it all.
So do you kind of see that being embodied in today's Apple?
Well, it left Apple for a long time, I would say, but it's back. Yeah, you definitely can see. Just hold an iPod in your hand. It's so beautiful. You feel that the love and attention to detail that the design team put into it. I actually know that the main implementer of the iPod, Tony Fidel, was a 22-year-old kid when he hired at one of the companies I helped start, General Magic. So I was so pleased to see Tony do something so great.
And you think that's all about Steve Jobs and his personality?
Well, it's not only about Steve Jobs, but one really key ingredient is visionary leadership, and that's what Steve provides. The passion. I sometimes think of him as sort of the id that's driving the collective consciousness.
In the book, you take an even-handed approach to Steve, and some people have sort of vilified Steve, and some people have idealized Steve as this great visionary. So what's your take on Steve?
Well, I'm trying to, first off, take an even-handed take on everybody, not just Steve. And doing, you know, as I already said, I had these issues about betraying the confidence of my friends. So the one thing I clung to was just the truth. I tried to just tell it as it happened and not try to judge it. Now, I was aware because I want to be artful, and so I orchestrated the details and put together the anecdotes so, like, kind of be in between the lines, you can read in some of the points and how it relates to the greater whole. But I try to refrain from being judgmental. And so Steve, you know, Steve's a complicated character. He's absolutely far and away the best boss I ever had, but he's also far and away the worst boss I ever had. Sometimes in the same actions, he can be the very best and the very worst.
Well, so tell us about that.
Well, I mean, one simple example is he'll come by, see what you're doing, and look over your shoulder and say, "That's the worst thing I've ever seen." But maybe the next day he'd come by and look at very much the same thing and say, "That's incredibly great." And it's his internal states that are being reflected more than that. But it's not just that, because he has a technique of he wants to find out if you believe in what you're doing. So often he will give gratuitous criticism that he doesn't even believe himself, but he'll just challenge you to make sure that you believe in what you're doing. And if you challenge him and fall apart, he'll lose respect for you. And so part of how the Mac team was selected, we were the people who believed in what we were doing enough to stand up to occasional withering criticism.
I mean, that's part of the story.
Steve is a manipulative guy. I'm sorry to interrupt. And so he has many techniques for manipulation. That's one of them. But he's great. What's greatest about Steve is he himself really wants to do the greatest possible thing, and he'll drag you along. You know, he will not be satisfied with just it being good. It has to be, you know, in his phrase, insanely great.
That kind of gets into the story about how you got on the team. I mean, you mentioned, you know, his criteria for getting on the team. So
yes.
You talked about a little bit in the book when you kind of go over that.
Yeah. Well, the first when I first met with him talking about it, he goes, "Are you any good? You know, I'm not sure you're good enough to work on the Mac." And, you know, how do you answer that? You know, yeah, I think I'm pretty good. I was already helping my friend Burl, you know, on the side. And then the second thing he asked me, "Are you creative? I hear you're creative." And I don't know how to answer that, but I said, I'm not the best person to judge. But then finally, when he just said, what he really did in that time, I don't even say it in the book, but there was a time delay when I kind of was talking with him in his office, and like 3 hours later, he came by to say, "Hey, you're on the team," and the funny story is he unplugged my Apple II. I said, "Oh, I'll come tomorrow. Let me just finish up what I'm working on right now." And he goes, that's never going to amount to anything. And he actually pulled my computer out of the wall. You know, he unplugged it. So I lost everything I was working on. And then he picked up the computer and started walking away. So what could I do but follow him? what he did in between that time where I interviewed with him in the office and he came by at my cubicle to fetch me was he went back to the Mac group and asked every single person who was already on the team, "Hey, what do you think of this Hertzfeld guy?" And I guess I got good enough feedback that I was on the team. And so that repeated with every new person. We agonized over, you know, hey, you know, is this person one of us? You know, we interviewed many people who had worked on advanced technology at MIT or Xerox PARC who were repelled by what we were doing. They saw the Macintosh and there's no way they'd work on it because we had such a small amount of memory. They were used to programming computers with literally 10 times the RAM, and they just, you know, when we explained to them what they were doing, they just didn't get it because, you know, we were being so parsimonious to keep the costs down. So in some ways, the process was self-selecting because every once in a while, there was that person who had the experience with the advanced systems who said, oh, that's incredibly great. It can sell for only $1,500. And then, of course, the acid test for seeing if someone was really one of us was when we showed them the machine. And if they just were said, oh, that's impressed or whatever, we didn't think they were one of us. But if their eyes lit up and they got excited, you know, then we knew they should be on the Mac team.
And you wanted to see that passion.
Yeah. Because we really believed in what we were doing, almost everyone on the team. Now, as the team got bigger and bigger, that became less and less true. And that's one of, you know, at the core, if you see a great product, at the core of it is a passionate individual, depending on the complexity of it, a passionate team.
You mentioned in the book that there were times when you and I think a few other individuals would be the only ones there late at night, and the rest of the team had gone home.
Yes.
And had lives yes. And all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, who was in that core group of folks?
Well, what happened actually was, many programmers actually, even in other parts of Apple, I think it's just a tradition to work for hackers to work late at night that comes from the days when mainframes were really expensive, so all day they'd be running, you know, banking software, and at night was when you'd get to play with them. That was certainly the case at university, you know, the time-sharing machine would just be 4 times faster in the evening. So you just stay up all night to program if you wanted the best response. And so I always worked after dinner. Also, the other thing is for me, programming is fun. You know, it's not just my work. It's my avocation.
Your calling?
As well. Yeah, yeah, you could say it's a calling. I love doing it. So I always came back after dinner to work for a few hours. My friend Burl, who was the hardware designer, was very much like that. Bud Tribble was another one, the first programmer on the Mac team. He would work only at night. Sometimes he wouldn't until he had the team got a little bigger and he had some responsibilities during the day. He would come in at like 4 p.m. and leave at around 6 a.m. Just his, I think he was a med student, and that maybe he got that habit from interning late at night. But then what happened is, Steve would always come by maybe around after dinner, around 7 or 8 p.m., maybe partially to see who's still there, but mainly just to, gossip with us about, show him he wanted to see the latest stuff. And then people were attracted to Steve, of course, and so more and more people started staying late until by, the spring of 1983, there were lots of people staying late. By the fall of 1983, the entire software team was working till the evening because we just had to meet our deadlines. So we had about, 3 or 4 months where it was, it was a bit of a grind.
You see that in the stuff you're doing nowadays, that same kind of grind? Or?
Well, I'm older now. For one thing, when you have a family, you just can't afford to do that anymore. So we were all in our 20s, and most of us didn't have any other obligations like that. The Mac was literally the most important thing in our lives at that point. And then I got married in my 30s, and, I just couldn't afford to do that quite so much. But I still find both late evenings and vacation times, like that very last week of the year, is some of the very best times for getting great code written.
So what do you end up doing nowadays?
Well, I'm still, just enjoying the launch of my book. I made enough money from actually a company that was a failure. General Magic was a very ambitious failure. I was one of the co-founders, and I ended up making enough money, so I don't really have to work. So I just work on what pleases me the most, and my current pet project is putting together a video server. So all of my movies, DVDs, rock video clips are online, much more accessible to me than they were. I did that with music 6 years ago in the spring of 1998 when I learned about MP3s. I saw the opportunity to transform the way I listen to music. I'm a passionate music fan. And so I developed just my own server with Perl scripts, and it was one of the most satisfying projects I've ever done, even though it was really just for me. It actually isn't just for me, because the music has a low enough bandwidth that I let all my friends stream from my server, too. I have about 7,000 albums on it. Not all my friends, but, you know, all the ones who are interested. I can support maybe, you know, 20, 30 people on it. I have a T1 line in my house. And yeah, when I left General Magic, the internet was just blossoming like crazy, and I figured I ought to learn about it. So the best way to learn was to get a T1 line and set up a little ISP for my free ISP for my friends. So I got to learn every single aspect of being an internet network administrator. And so I also, for one time, to justify it, I did a bunch of pro bono projects, and at one time I had a monopoly on food bank websites in the Bay Area. I hosted 4 of them.
That's awesome. What kind of stuff did you take from Apple and use in General Magic? Did you take anything from Steve's person? You know?
Well, no. Well, Steve was long gone from Apple at the time General Magic spun off, and John Scully was really the one, through his relationship with Bill Atkinson. The reason I worked at General Magic is Bill, as you can tell from reading my book, was my mentor, my guiding light, the person who taught me how to do what I do. And so when the opportunity arose to work with Bill closely again, I just had to do it. And then through Bill's great relationship with John Scully, he got us to eventually, Apple spun us off and rolled out the red carpet for us. Mark Perat was kind of the key instigator. He was an Apple researcher and, you know, one of those guys who's a terrific salesman. And he really put together the vision for General Magic of a small handheld computer whose main job was communicating. You know, sort of a little bit like maybe what the Trio is now. But this was in 1990. That was quite a bold vision, and we thought it was worthwhile to make it happen. Very much like the attitude with the Mac, we were going to change the world again. But Mark's idea was this time. You know, we had already by 1990 see a little bit of how the whole computer industry played out, and realized that, you know, Apple couldn't go it alone to establish a standard. So we wanted, Mark's idea was to bring in Sony and Motorola. So John Scully introduced us to Sony and Motorola, and when General Magic first spun out, its board of directors consisted of myself, Bill Atkinson, and Mark Perat, just basically these engineers, and then the chairman of the board of Sony, the chairman of the board of Motorola, and the chairman of the board of Apple, you know, some of the top business people in the world. Turns out that wasn't a good idea, because you had such big wigs on the board, we didn't have real board meetings to guide the company. It was always just a dog and pony show for these guys. And so I wouldn't recommend that, but that's what happened. But so anyway, General Magic got this great start. We were doing great work, but then John Scully ended up betraying us. About a year later, he decided that we were doing so well that he wanted Apple to do it all. He kind of forgot why he needed the alliance, changed the Newton project to do something very similar. When at the time General Magic spun out, the Newton was a full-page display and projected to cost $5,000, a much different thing than what we were trying to do. And then he just changed the Newton to be with us and told Sony and Motorola to drop us, wanting to essentially kill our company. And luckily for us, Sony and Motorola didn't drop us, so we had both the MagicCap devices and the Newton. But it kind of broke the heart of the company to have our father want to drown us, you know, choke us to death in the cradle, basically. And that's one of the reasons I think that why Newton didn't make it either was kind of dividing that effort instead of working together.
Although in a certain way, Newton is still alive through its enthusiasts.
Yeah, through its enthusiasts, but it's I would say that's a half-life. You know, it's
certainly an aberration.
It's not the Newton ghost still haunts us, maybe, but it's not alive as a product. It could have been, actually. It was still going at the time Steve Jobs took over Apple again in 1997. The Newton, they had a really cute little computer called the E-Mate, I think, that was based on the Newton platform that everyone was excited about, and the Newton itself. They finally had, like, the strong arm chip, and, like, the MessagePad 2000 was a promising model. Palm had already taken the momentum, but the Newton was still a big player. But Steve Jobs shut it down and essentially flushed it down the toilet, and, of course, I know why. which was, it was John Scully's, it was Scully's baby.
And, oh, so it was political, and, it wasn't technological.
Yes. Steve wanted to purge Apple of every sign of John Scully. Oh, Steve hates John Scully, there's no doubt about it. Because Scully kicked him out, and Scully broke his heart, and you know, he just doesn't want to be around anything associated with John Scully. That's also, I think, why Apple dropped HyperCard.
Actually, I heard a rumor one time about the development of HyperCard, just now that you bring it up,
right?
About Bill Atkinson actually being in a hotel room for, like, months building that thing? Or
no, no, he worked in his house.
Oh, okay.
Bill, even in the Mac days, writing QuickDraw and stuff, he didn't really have a desk at Apple. He would work at home and then come to Apple to show everyone what he did. And HyperCard was very much the same way. It was written in the office of his house at Los Gatos. And in fact, Bill only had one. He had a few people helping him in the later stages, but only one key collaborator, Dan Winkler, who wrote the HyperTalk scripting language. And to do that, Dan moved into Bill's house instead of Bill moving to Apple.
Was it a Skunkworks project that kind of went
large? It was just Bill. It was Bill, you know, using his vision and insight to figure out, you know, the next great thing to do, and then doing it.
Essentially the dynamic
actually,
Mac
there was
Paint.
Actually a seed. Yeah, it was, in a way, it was the next version of Mac Paint. But Bill had also written a very simple little address card database called Rolodex that was the first seed of HyperCard.
So you mentioned that Magic Hat has kind of had its ups and downs.
Yeah, it was called Magic Cat.
Magic Cat, my bad.
Well, yeah, actually, General Magic essentially failed in its mission. I probably could list about a dozen different reasons, but essentially the company, after shipping initial products with Motorola and Sony, we had signed up 14 licensees, actually, but only three or four of them ever shipped products. And the products did, they did okay initially, but not up to the great expectations. I think Sony sold about 20,000 units. And it really, they were, you know, would have taken more than that. But I really think one of the key mistakes is we signed up too many partners. And, like, our relationship with Sony changed fundamentally when we signed up their arch enemy, Matsushita. You know, Mark Pratt, who was orchestrating it all, used to talk about keeping the various large companies. You know, we had this fear of working with some of the biggest companies of the world. We're this tiny little software company, of getting kind of swallowed up by them. And so Mark used the phrase dynamic tension by having different axes, each one having a competitor there. It kind of kept things balanced. But unfortunately, that also weakened their commitment to us. And so after Sony did a second generation of the product, it also did not terribly, but also not greatly. We sort of lost. And then the other thing that happened, though, is right then the internet boom was just exploding in 1995. And we were doing something similar but different. We actually made a really key mistake embracing AT&T. If I had to pick one thing that killed the company, was working too closely with AT&T, who encouraged us to use proprietary, not encouraged, but insisted that we use proprietary communication standards in order to lock in customers. And so we had a chance. We could have used the internet protocols, but, you know, Jim White, who was one of the telecommunications geniuses who was working at General Magic and a guy who's made a lot of different breakthroughs, he was the visionary behind the Telescript programming language that was at the heart of what General Magic was doing, explained it in terms of a many-decade war between two approaches to standards, the telephone companies approach and the university's approach that essentially was the internet. And we essentially lined up on the wrong side of that. Our values and spirit and everything about it should have made us line up with the open standards. But General Magic instead, for commercial reasons, lined up with the telcos. And that was one of the main reasons I think we eventually failed.
Part of the mystery of Apple is why it keeps going so well in the face of the PC Wintel monopoly.
Well, I don't know if it really did there for a while. I remember reading a lot of premature obituaries around 1996.
So what do you think's brought it back?
Steve Jobs, obviously. I mean, I think, you know, they bought the next software, you know, just because their efforts had failed. And the next software was really good, but that wasn't the thing that saved them. The thing that saved them was Steve himself, who had a very complex relationship with Apple at that point. He loved it, but he also felt distant from it. I know it was very hard for him to decide whether or not to come back in an operating role because he thought it might be past saving. But he, you know, he was able to get a handle on those complex feelings and put himself into it. You might remember he refrained from taking the title of CEO for at least 2 or 3 years. There's no question he saved Apple by bringing it back to its roots of really passionately caring about the products again. That's the big difference. As well, Steve's a marketing genius too, and I think you see that reflected everywhere. And his very first act, actually, I don't even know, I wasn't there, but one of the very first things he did as soon as he got into the driver's seat there again was make that Think Different commercial, which was really, according to him, actually, to remind the Apple employees of why they were working there. And that commercial, if you know Steve, that commercial is so Steve, because those are all his heroes lined up one after another in order.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Starting with Albert Einstein, then Bob Dylan, et cetera.
What impact do you think the Macintosh community had on the revival or on the maintenance?
Well, they kept it alive. They kept, well, the flame was burning dim. You know, the diehards stood by it. People love their Mac. Partially because they feel the love that went into it. So, enough of the diehards stuck around to keep the business from failing. And then Steve, once he came back, energized the product development, and they came out with some good products and got on their way again. And luckily, the iPod, you know, my theory about the iPod, I was into the MP3s pretty early. I even had a conversation with Steve when I started doing it in 1998, explaining to him how excited I was to make a CD, a single CD that had every Beatles album on it.
Right.
And he kind of poo-pooed it. He said, MP3, low quality, who would ever want to listen to that? And I had a something conceptually the same as an iPod, but much more clunky design. It was probably three times the size, but a little made by some Korean company. It was actually designed at the DEC Research Lab by people I knew. That's how I found out about it. But it was a iPod with a five gigabyte hard disk and clunky UI, but it did everything the iPod did. I had one of those in 1999. And so one of my theories about why the iPod was successful was Apple was a little late with it compared to their track record of being years ahead of the market. In this case, they came in just right at the perfect time, where using their incredible design skills, they were able to make something exquisite just as it was ready to come off. And I think maybe if the iPod had come out a year sooner, it might not have captured everyone's imagination like it did.
So where do you see Apple going next?
Well, there's a lot of different directions. I'm really pleased with the announcements at this show of trying to move to a broader audience. I'm hoping they make more things for my pocket and my living room.
Personal devices?
Yeah. I think there's would be great to see a telephone or some kind of pocket communications oriented device like we were trying to do at General Magic. That would, be a nice meaty thing for Apple to take on. I have no idea if they're actually I do know that they had been developing a cell phone here and there, but they, at least thus far, have never thought they got it right enough yet. And as you probably know, they're partnering with Motorola to get the iTunes stuff. But that's not what I mean. I mean something that's fully Apple designed and that fits in your pocket. And I think these days, well, I think maybe a great idea for them would be, because I think one of the stumbling blocks in doing something great in the cell phone space are all of the cell phone companies who have a draconian business model of tight control over their network. And I think they just wouldn't let you make a great product because they're so constipated. I think there's an end around that's emerging soon of IP telephony. I would love to see Apple make a pocket device oriented toward IP telephony. I have no idea if they will.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right.